This is Embodied from the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Since the death of George Floyd in late May, race, racism, and police brutality have yet again emerged front and center in public consciousness. From nationwide protests drawing multiracial crowds to companies issuing public Black Lives Matter statements, conversations about race are almost impossible to avoid right now. But these conversations can be challenging to navigate, especially if you're not already accustomed to having them. Today, we're going to talk about how some interracial couples are talking through this political and deeply personal moment. Joining me is Sarah E. Gaither. She's an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Candace Manriquez Wren. She's a director and producer for Marketplace. Candace, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Rain Bennett, filmmaker and host of the Storytelling Lab podcast. Rain, thanks for being on the show.
Absolutely. Great to hear your voice, Anita.
So, Sarah, you are biracial. You are someone who studies biracial identity and interracial interactions. So give us some context for this moment. What is happening for couples when these political, big political protest moments are happening? Obviously, there's a lot of difference based on the particular couple, but just give us kind of a general sense.
Right. So outside of our current social context and social climate, talking about race is usually not something any of us do for fun. It is something we should all be doing on a daily basis. And that's what we're seeing now due to the increases of protests across the country is they're giving us ample opportunities to recognize race, think about race, reflect on our own personal encounters, whether we did something to someone or something happened to us. So it's making these conversations much more salient across racial and ethnic group lines. We're seeing discussions of parents trying to figure out how to talk about race with their kids for the first time. Friends and romantic partners are being forced to consider things that they've never thought about before. You know, what is the history that maybe your partner or loved one has faced across their life? So it's really causing us to grapple with these things in a forced way, but a new way too at the same time.
When we look at interracial marriages in particular in the U.S., I know there has been a dramatic shift over the past 50 or so years. How common are interracial marriages today?
So we're actually seeing interracial marriages at an all-time high. So Loving versus Virginia was passed in 1967, which is what actually made interracial marriages legal for the first time in modern U.S. history. And so now we're seeing actually one of the most common cross-race marriage patterns in the country. And so we're seeing more mixed-race kids, more interracial couples. But at the same time, we're still not seeing 100% acceptance of interracial marriages at the same time. The Pew results in recent polls and surveys have shown some increases in accepting cross-race partnerships, particularly cross-race relationships between white and Black individuals are still viewed pretty negatively.
Candace, tell me about your own story. You are in an interracial marriage now. When you and your husband first got together, how often did you all talk about race? How did it come up in your relationship?
Well, my husband, I met him when I was in graduate school studying race and gender in media. So we talked about race all the time because it was part of my job. Mm. My husband is white presenting, and I say white presenting because he is part Japanese, but is read by most people as white. And I had dated other white and non-Black men before him. And one of the things that came up in prior relationships or in dating was they would say, you know, you talk about race a lot. And that was really off-putting to me because one, I live in race. I mean, I'm a Black woman, but it was also my job. Mm. And to tell me that I bring home my work too much was in itself an affront. So from the very beginning, we talked about race on a daily basis. I have children from a previous marriage. My husband was going to have to take on Black children if he wanted to be with me.
Well, it's so interesting because as you're saying that, you're like, you know, I have been having these conversations my whole life because I have had no choice. And a lot of white families may be encountering right now that a big part of white privilege is the privilege to not talk about these conversations, to not acknowledge your own race and the significance of it in these everyday interactions until you are really forced to do that.
Absolutely. And I've seen that time and again. I've actually even seen it with my husband. So like I said, we talk a lot about race almost on a daily basis, especially these days. But he will admit to you that before he was with me, there were a lot of things that he didn't see. His eyes were open to a lot of things because he sees how he is treated versus how I am treated, how his stepchildren are seen. There are interactions that he never had in his previous marriage to a non-Black woman that he has with me. One brief example is when we go out to dinner, for instance, many, many times we'll be sitting together, we'll be talking just like a normal couple, and we'll be interacting as a couple. But so often the server will ask, do you want separate checks? And that's never happened to me when I was out with a Black man, and that had never happened to him before.
That's really interesting. Rain, you are also with us. You live in Durham. You are a filmmaker and host of the Storytelling Lab podcast. You are also in an interracial marriage. And I wonder, I mean, what have been some of the things that you and your wife have encountered in this moment in trying to have conversations about race and what's going on?
Well, I mean, for me, daily I see the struggle that she's going through. And so as a partner, I just try to be there for her as much as I can. In terms of what we encounter internally with our relationship within our home, we are constantly having to talk about this because as a white man, even one that's been, you know, very much a part of the Black community my whole life, like I always have something to learn. And it's kind of a privilege for me to have someone in the house who, like, we have to keep the relationship decent that night, right? That we can like calmly like talk through things. I will say she's very patient with me, but also it's a blessing to have someone like a lot of what I learn, I put out publicly through films, through writing and through my articles, and to address some of these harder to talk about things. And it's good to have, for me to have her to kind of bounce those things off of, because it's not easy even like for a white person to talk about these things. And this is the challenge that has been presented historically. Those that may want to speak out or to stand up at the first sign of any kind of struggle or obstacle, which there are obviously going to be, they tend to fall back. And I feel like for once I'm finally seeing that tide shift, where people who have not spoken up before finally having the courage to speak up. And while my wife can watch that maybe cautiously, because she's probably seen that before, it leaves me with hope, because I see I hope that I see the tide shifting.
Well, there's so many layers to these conversations, Sarah. And I mean, there's kind of that first step of even being willing to acknowledge that there is a problem, acknowledge that there's a systemic problem, acknowledge your potential role in it, work through the guilt that you have about not having acknowledged this before, then maybe think about learning, then maybe moving to action. And so it requires kind of consistent effort and engagement. But for people who are maybe at the beginning stages, what do you encourage them to do to be a graceful participant in these conversations? Because there's a lot that, as we've been saying, you know, Black folks and other people of color, this is not a new conversation for them.
Yeah, I think the advice I give to people who are working on trying to become an ally for the first time, first, please, yes, join the movement, join the cause. It's really important we have everyone at this table. But I'd encourage you all to start small. Don't just jump into very difficult racial and ethnic related conversations. I would encourage you all to listen first. Read Black Twitter, look at social media stories, watch your local news, and do a diversity search of the types of people that are interviewed, and really hear people's stories and hear people's experiences, and allow yourself time to actually process this new information. It is a lot to think about, particularly for white and high status individuals who have not been forced to think about racism before. So take it in small doses, find some self-care time to process it effectively so that you can go back into conversation number 2, 3, and 4, because we need to keep these conversations going even beyond whenever the protests may end, if they do.
And I guess a part of it too, Candace, I wonder is, you know, being able to opt in to having the conversation. And there is an assumption right now that I feel like I've been seeing on social media that, you know, anyone who is Black is just going to be willing to opt into to these conversations whenever white people are there and ready to do so. And that's just not the case.
Yeah, that's absolutely not the case. I mean, this time that we're living in is simultaneously exhausting and invigorating. It is it is a time for white people to do the reading, to do the listening, to do the learning, and not assume that, first of all, all black people have the answers. We don't have the answers. You know, there are things that we may be privy to that white people may not be privy to, but that doesn't mean that we want to be open with that knowledge all the time. So, you know, do the reading yourself, do the learning yourself. And then if you have a trusted black friend, you know, a true black friend, not the quote black friend, if you have a trusted friend, then come to them and ask, you know, about their experiences. But yeah, I think it's right now, I think a lot of black people feel like it's on white people to help fix this problem.
I want to play a clip now from someone we spoke with in Fayetteville. His name is Dwight Sullivan, and this is what he had to say about conversations with his Latino wife.
Under regular circumstances, it doesn't come up often at all. It generally comes up when we're, I guess, faced with some type of situation. For instance, when we were dating, we went into a restaurant in Florida and everybody turned their head, like E.F. Hutton had just said something. Everybody stopped eating and looked at us. You know, we'll talk about it then. You know, we generally talk about it when we see something that is controversial by one group or another. Well, sometimes it's kind of like, I can't believe white folks are doing that. I can't believe that they don't see that that's wrong. They don't see me.
That's Dwight Sullivan of Fayetteville. I'm here with Sarah E. Gaither, Candace Manriquez-Wren, and Rain Bennett. Rain, I want to hear a bit more about the history of your relationship and how the two of you have navigated your interracial partnership with other white folks in your life. I know after President Trump's election, you wrote a big piece for the Huffington Post about the experience of confronting your own family and some of their racial prejudice. Tell us a bit about that and the experience of, you know, being an interracial couple out in public, out in the world, around North Carolina, not just in Durham.
So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the first ways that I tried to face this and address this in an uncomfortable way that I feel like did a lot of good, got some decent response, and it wasn't perfect, but that's the point I feel is to try to get better. A lot of our experience around North Carolina has been pretty positive because we're in a place that's accepting and it's a melting pot here in Durham. However, I'll say when we first started dating, she would notice looks and things like that if we were at the grocery store together. And like, I had this moment that I remember clear as day where she mentioned that and I'm completely oblivious to it. Now granted, I was being silly and like flirting with her in the store, but the point is like, I don't see that sort of thing because I didn't have to see that sort of thing. I didn't see the looks from people. And so that was one of the moments early in our relationship before the Huffington Post article where I was like, yep, that is the essence of white privilege right there. I don't even have to notice these things around me. And so, as I said, I just tried to get better, and I just want to plus 1,000 to what Sarah said. Like, I see so many people jumping on this movement now, which is awesome. However, I see a lot of people jumping on and trying to go big. And I'm one of these people. When I had this conversation with my wife 2 weeks ago, I'm thinking like, I have a platform, you know, people will respect me and listen to me. What big thing can I do to help this? And she just calmly said, it's not about one big thing. It's about a lot of little things consistently over time. And so what I urge other white people to do is not try to jump on board and solve it this week, because that will not happen and you will burn out. But instead, to make this a part of your system, your processes, and think about the small actions you can take on a daily basis that will help shift this tide. I think that is the way to progress.
And also acknowledge, you know, white people have been taking up a lot of space for a long time. So maybe it's the time to step back for a second.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that like that our minds go to thinking of the big thing that we can do to fix it, the fact that we think we can just fix it with the click of a button, is white privilege. We've been told our whole lives that if we just put our mind to it, we can solve this thing. And it's not true. So taking a back seat, listening, as Sarah also said, and just making it a part of our routines, you know, where we shop, who we talk to, where we spend our money, who we vote for, how we interact with the world. It's about those consistent steps.
Candace, have there been any conversations that have been really hard to have within your partnership, even though you have built this foundation and you all have worked together on anti-racism?
You know, I wouldn't say hard in the sense that my husband's not open to it, but I think that it's always hard to bear your experiences 100% with someone who cannot embody those experiences. Just recently, in the last couple of weeks, I've had a couple of breakdowns where I've really lost it. I have a Black son and I've just really lost it. And I think it's really hard for anybody who to empathize with that, who can't 100%. But I will say that I am lucky in that I'm married to someone who really, really tries, who really tries.
Sarah, moving forward, I mean, do you think that this is a breaking point? It's obviously a breaking point in some ways, but do you think this is going to cause long-term change, or is the conversation going to go back to normal?
I would like to say yes. I would love to say yes, but I think we've seen the same type of response in some ways with Michael Brown, with Trayvon Martin, and people get very invigorated and very ready and excited to help promote change whenever these protests start happening. What happens is people do lose steam, they do lose energy, and right now under stay-at-home orders, many people who have time right now to protest and create petitions are not going to have time when jobs open back up and everyone returns back to school and all of those things. And so I hope things will get better. I do think we are seeing some new shifts. Just within the last few years, there is a 6% increase in people having more cross-race friends based on the general social survey. So there seems to be some increases in integration across our country. But racism is, again, something, as Rain said, we're not going to solve it overnight. And we need these conversations, these protests. We need us to be strategizing forever in order to make sure that we're making this world a more just place. And I just worry people will run out of energy.
Rain, I only have about a minute left, but do you have any kind of quick tips for white folks who want to engage their white families in these conversations? Any tips from your own experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Baby steps, as we've said already, empathy, patience, but also protecting yourself. I mean, I am very close to my family. I have a small family, but my priorities have shifted now that I have my own daughter who's going to grow up biracial and be seen by the world as a Black woman. So you have to have these hard conversations. Just try to do it from a place of empathy. And if you have to peel out to take care of yourself and your mental health, do it.
Thanks so much to all of my guests, Candace Manriquez-Wren, director and producer for Marketplace, Rain Bennett, filmmaker and host of The Storytelling Lab. Thank you both so much. And Duke Assistant Professor Sarah Gaither is going to stick with us, but I will say goodbye again to Candace and Rain. Thank you, Candace and Rain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we are going to continue this conversation and look at friendships and dynamics in the workplace. You may have been hearing the phrase, check on your Black friends, in the past few weeks. But should you send that text or should you hold off? We will hear some perspectives when we continue this conversation on Embodied just ahead. Please stay with us. This is Embodied from the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Home is not the only place where it can be difficult to talk about race and racism. It is tough in work relationships and friendships, too. If you're one of the only people of color in your office or the only Black friend your white friend has, national protest against racial violence can be an elephant in the room. Your white friends may sense that something supportive needs to be said, but they aren't quite sure how to say it. So what should they do? And what should they not do? Sarah Gaither is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke, and she is still with us. And joining the conversation now is Priska Neely. She's a reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Priska, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You wrote a really wonderful piece last week for New York Magazine's The Cut, and it was called I Don't Need Your Check-In Texts. So tell us a little bit about what this essay was about and what inspired it.
Yeah, you know, it started, you know, I live in Oakland, which kind of prides itself as a very woke town. And the day after George Floyd was killed, I started getting texts that were just saying, hey, you know, I can't imagine what the Black community is feeling right now. Can't imagine what you're going through. Kind of, I'm here for you. And this was happening on various degrees, you know, with people who are in my circle and some who really aren't. And I was checking in with some other Black friends who live on the East Coast and in other parts of the country. And I was like, hey, you know, is this happening to you? And they said that it wasn't, you know, at the beginning of the week. But toward the end of the week, when there were more of these memes that I was seeing on Twitter and Instagram, they also started getting these check-in texts, you know, can't imagine what's happening, want to apologize, you know, for the, you know, all of these different varying takes on the same language. And I just felt like I had the capacity to write about what it was like to be on the receiving end. I was hearing from a lot of friends who were like, I can't even respond to these texts right now. So I wanted to write this piece to put out there. Like, I understand the intention. I understand what you're trying to accomplish in acknowledging the moment. But this is not new for me. This is not a new, you know, whatever you think that I may be feeling right now is really not new. As a Black woman in the United States, as a journalist who covers issues of reproductive justice and, you know, the stress and how toxic stress affects Black women and their babies, this is not new for me. So the check-ins were just, it was very confusing.
And were these check-ins new? Had this happened before?
It had never happened before like this. I mean, you know, sometimes friends, I have a lot of working in public radio and going to the college that I went to, which was a very predominantly white college. I have a lot of non-Black friends. But this was a new thing that I really felt like people were responding to this social media language of check in on your Black friends, check in on people of color this week. It sometimes just didn't feel super genuine, even if it was well-intentioned. And it really wasn't something that I had experienced like that before.
Sarah, what do you make of this phenomenon? I mean, and I was seeing it a ton, you know, check in on your Black and brown friends, check in on your Black and brown colleagues. If you're a manager, make sure you check in on your Black and brown people that you supervise. What do you make of this?
I think it's complicated. I think, you know, as she's saying, some of this is very well-intentioned, and it's people trying to grapple with what's happening in our country right now in a way that they think is going to be positive. But I don't think white individuals in particular realize how tired members of the Black community are right now in thinking about these things on a daily basis. And this isn't new. As she also said, this is something that Black people face every day, and yet no one's ever checked on them before. So I think it's complicated. Things that I tell people to do when they've even reached out to me, and I'm a very white passing biracial Black white individual, I've had many people who are parents of kids, and they want me to sort of vet certain books and things. Like, is this a good enough book to read to my kid to make them not racist? So these things are happening. But what I encourage people to do is spend a little time on the internet Googling other things you can do. You can teach yourself about these injustices that the Black community has faced for the past 400 years in our country. You don't necessarily need to ask your Black friend to explain why it is we're having these protests. And so those are some conversations I'm trying to push on people who are reaching out to me as well.
Priska, for you, I mean, as you said, there's people kind of both in your close circle and bigger. So for those, it maybe more in your close circle, some of whom reached out to you, are these people that you have had conversations about race and racism with before? Is that something that comes up in your cross-racial friendships?
You know, one thing that I realize is that, and I say this probably happened in the past 3 years or so when I really have been reporting on the toll of racism on Black women, I've started having more conversations with white friends about my own experience as a Black woman. And I think that before, maybe I didn't talk to them. I would talk to other Black people about it, but I wouldn't talk to my non-Black friends about it as much. So that's something that I realized and that I kind of challenged myself to do in the last few years, because I realized that I wasn't sharing my full self with some people. But in response to this check-in moment, there were a couple of friends who I knew they were really trying to do the right thing and were kind of waking up in this moment right now. And we are real friends. And so I took the time to have conversations and say, hey, I know you may be responding to this meme or this advice to do this, but it's actually not, it's not what I want. I've talked to a couple other people who it's not super helpful for them. Like, I appreciate the fact that you read my stories. I appreciate the fact that you listen to the work that I do. I like it when you send me pictures of your dog or your baby, but I don't need this kind of loaded, how are you question. And so I had a couple of, you know, quote, difficult conversations with friends who were doing this, and it was slightly uncomfortable, but it actually felt better. Like, it felt like we were closer having gone through that conversation. So I think leaning into discomfort right now is something that we all need to be more comfortable with.
And maybe, I mean, part of it could be acknowledging, you know, who is actually a real friend outside of this moment and who was, you know, an acquaintance from high school, which, like, you don't have an existing relationship. And Sarah, I mean, it kind of points to this bigger conversation about social networks and how they are formed and how diverse they are. I mean, how diverse are our social networks, I guess? What does the research show?
You know, so documenting statistically how diverse everyone's friend networks are is tricky. It's not tracked by the census, like marriage rates or anything like that. But some recent polls have shown that over 40% of white Americans and even around 20-25% of non-white or racial ethnic minorities are surrounded exclusively by friends of their own race. And I think a lot of this is linked to the fact that we're still living in a completely racially and ethnically segregated society. It's really hard for us to make those true, real friends across racial and ethnic group lines. When you broaden these statistics out to look at coworker networks, friends, relatives, it really shows that overall, regardless of people's backgrounds, at least 30% of Americans are really not having any sort of social relationship with people from other racial or ethnic backgrounds. And I'd argue a lot of these are probably an underestimate, because we know people are very biased when they fill out surveys about race, and they like to say they have lots of Black friends when really they maybe only have one. So I just caution people when they read statistics like this to really think, are these statistics really accurate or not? So I think we're moving in the right direction, but we're still seeing very racially segregated networks.
That's interesting, because it kind of points to all of the systemic forces along the way. You know, friendship has a lot to do with proximity. So if you went to a school that was mostly white folks and lived in a neighborhood that was mostly white folks and then went to a college, like, all of those factors are going to shape how your social network is built.
Exactly. And this starts as kids, right? Cross-race friendships in childhood, those already start to be biased because of those neighborhoods you're living in or the school you might be attending or the friends your parents even allow you to have. And what I would love to tell everyone is that despite all the stigma of how difficult cross-race friendships can be from childhood through adulthood, having meaningful cross-race friendships actually increases your self-esteem, it increases your social competence, and you're really just a better overall person. You can think more flexibly. You can even problem solve more creatively with more diversity in your life.
I want to play a clip now from a teenager that we did speak with. Her name is Camelia. She's a high school student in Silver Spring, Maryland. And this is what she said about talking about race with her friends.
You can continue to explain how you feel about this subject over and over again and the facts and everything. But if people want to stay in that ignorant set of mind, they're going to stay in that ignorant set of mind. It's like acknowledging the facts, but still, because they feel so comfortable and it's something that they know to be racist or ignorant or whatever, they'll just sit in it and they'll just ignore the facts. You know, they'll acknowledge it, but they won't take it in.
So that's high school student Camelia Floyd on talking about race with friends. I'm with Sarah Gaither and Prisca Neely. Prisca, when you hear Camelia talk about that, what does that bring up for you? I mean, has your ability to have these conversations shifted as you have gotten older, as your social networks have expanded and grown?
Absolutely. Yeah. And Silver Spring. I'm from Silver Spring.
Oh, cool.
yeah, I think that, you know, this is complicated what we're talking about, because, you know, on the one hand, and some of the feedback that I've seen on social media from people who it seems like maybe didn't really read the whole piece that I wrote really focuses on, oh, well, you know, it's kind of damned if we do, damned if we don't, because we don't want to be checking in, but we also don't want to not say anything, not acknowledge it. And there is a lot of nuance there, because you don't want people to be oblivious to the moment and kind of just acting like there isn't anything going on that is really affecting the Black community. But I think that's why it's important to really examine friendships and just kind of know your place, like how important
how close of a friend are you? And one of the things that I kind of put forward in the piece that I wrote is like, what would you do if I weren't okay? You know, are you really prepared for the answer to this question? How are you? And it's not really an answer that I can put into words, but I think that, yeah, totally. It is kind of a newer thing for me, even, and something that I've challenged myself to do in realizing friendships can't really be authentic if I'm not talking about, if I share a story about a microaggression at work with my Black friend who also works in public radio, but not a white friend who maybe doesn't. But if it's something that's really on my mind, I should share it with my real friends. And the conversations may be different in the understanding and support, but you know, that is part of real friendship.
Well, what about the work dynamic, Sarah? I mean, there's obviously there are power dynamics there. There's maybe, you know, people's different levels of comfort with how much they share their personal lives with people at work. So what would you suggest to people who are wondering, you know, how to navigate this moment and these conversations cross-racially in their workplace?
I think you have to first look at your workplace context, right? Who's in those leadership positions? Can you reach out to those people instead of the people of color? Since we know on average, most people of color are not in leadership positions. And you can, as a white ally, go to those leaders and actually try and institute change within your own organization. Those types of actions are what we need everyone to be doing right now. But I think you also need to be careful when approaching these conversations, right? Don't just text your random Black coworker because you think you have to. If you don't really know them, that's, again, not going to be something that's helpful to them. And I think the other piece of advice that I would give anyone in a diverse working place is to make sure that you're aware that not all Black people are the same. Not all Latino people are the same. There's not this monolithic approach. So some people might love that text message check-in, and some people might not. And so what works with one individual might not work with another. And so making sure you're trying different approaches and listening to those responses that you end up getting in that workplace with an open mind, being able to perspective take and have empathy is absolutely key.
And that's a good point. I mean, kind of encouraging change on all levels, like if your end goal and thinking about what your end goal is, Prisca, I know that's something that you brought up a lot in your essay. Like, what are you actually trying to get out of this conversation? Mm-hmm. So for you, yeah, I just want you to reflect on the workplace piece of it as well.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of this kind of silence is violence, silence is compliance. But what are you really trying to accomplish with a check-in? And I think especially for the workplace, this shouldn't be the first time that you're realizing that you have Black employees, or have you realized that you don't have any Black employees? You know, I mean, there are so many different levels of kind of awakening for the various levels of this very complicated issue right now. But I think we really need to be careful with what are we going to say. I think being silent, if having an awakening right now and realize that you can't be silent, shouldn't just be now. It shouldn't be about tweeting something right now or maybe writing to the CEO right now if you don't have the words, if you don't have the support, if you don't know your Black colleague yet. You know, get to know them. And then 6 months from now, advocate for them. Like when we're back in our workplaces, when you're on a hiring committee and you have a chance to speak up or you have a chance to say, hey, let's post this job opening to this other forum where we may get a, you know, more diverse candidates. Like there's so much that needs to happen, as your guests in the previous segment were saying, beyond this moment, you know, not just right now, but like forever.
Yeah. And I think that's been my biggest struggle with social media is it's these very blanket statements about, you know, the work to do. And really, I feel like everyone has their own work that they need to do. And this moment needs to start with your own personal reckoning about kind of where you are in your own context and build your own template for the work that you're going to do from there. Seems like a good place to start to me. I don't know what y'all think.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's been interesting in the responses that I've gotten, I also was talking to someone I know, a Black woman who used to work at NPR in the 90s, and she said that she did a piece after the Rodney King uprising where she was, you know, had a group of Black people that she was interviewing, and they were talking about all the phone calls that they were getting from Caucasian, well-intentioned Caucasian friends. And one guy talked about being asked to give a presentation at work to like talk about racism. And it was just so funny to think about the fact that this was happening also in the 90s. And, you know, maybe in a different medium. So I understand the intention, and that's why I just don't want people to forget, you know, that happened in the 90s, that this will happen again. This is happening all the time for people. And just to really kind of realize that and how you're framing how you see the world.
Yeah. I wish I had time, Sarah, for your answer, but I don't, because we are running up against the clock. But I will say goodbye to you both, Sarah E. Gaither, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke, and Priska Neely, reporter and producer for the podcast Reveal. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about the show and all of our guests today at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.